may begin when you're ready.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank you. As Judge said, I was appointed to represent Derek Doggett. He was convicted in the Chesterfield Circuit Court, obviously, of the felony offense of racing. I have raised three issues in my petition for appeal. I think the facts are really determinative of what should happen on appeal. The evidence that I would point to and certainly ask the court to consider as it pertains to each of the three issues that I've raised is just what has happened, the totality of what has happened from start to finish. And so you have these folks in a parking lot having had an evening of bowling. There's no alcohol. There's no drugs. They're in the parking lot. There is no real conversation, certainly no conversation about a race happening. The parties get to a stoplight. There's a vehicle driven by my client with two passengers, and then a vehicle driven by Mr. Sam, just him alone. They get to a light. There is some variety of gesture, and then both gentlemen pull off. There is no revving of engines. There is no braking of traction. There is no spinning of tires. It sounds like each vehicle pulls off lawfully and then get in line behind one another. The evidence that there is with respect to what happens then is that they proceed the speed limit for a mile to a mile and a half, that at one point my client passes Mr. Sam without any effort by Mr. Sam to do anything. They drive about another mile going along at the speed limit. Mr. Sam attempts to pass my client. My client speeds up briefly. The person in the car with him says, "You need to slow down." Mr. Doggett takes his foot off the gas, slows down, and Mr. Sam loses control of the vehicle, and the accident happens.
Mr. Sheldon, Judge Beal.
Sir. Yes, sir.
Do I understand that you do not really take issue with the trial court's definition of a race? That is,
I think that, sir.
A contest of speed and a competition for first place?
I don't, and I think that we all had the same idea, both the prosecutor and myself, and then obviously Judge McCallum, which was to just look it up in the dictionary. There's certainly no definition given in the code. There really are no cases that deal with racing. There are certainly tangential issues, but nothing that deals with the elements of racing that I have found as far as in our jurisprudence. I don't really dispute what the definition is. A contest of speed, I didn't really have any great dispute with that when we tried the case.
You just referred to the fact that your client sped up briefly, but didn't his passenger, who's a very close friend of his, testify that not only did he speed up, but he looked at the speedometer and he was going between 55 and 60 miles per hour, which is more than 20 miles per hour over the speed limit there.
He did say that?
I'm sorry?
Yes, sir. He did say that.
And if that's the case, and that was at the point that Mr. Sam was trying to get back in front of him, and they're going down a two-lane road. I mean, there's only one lane going the way in which they're going, and there's no appreciable shoulder to the road. Even if you put aside nighttime and wet road conditions and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Why doesn't that show your clients showing essentially a reckless disregard for life?
I think, my answer to that would be, I think, rather than viewing just that short, and I'm looking at the transcript, and it's, I think, pages 31 through 32, with the young man you've referenced to testify, and he says, nobody's drinking, nobody's doing any drugs, and then just starts to describe the distances. And I think really the reason I believe the trial court was wrong was because I feel the trial court focused certainly on the speed in determining that this was a race. But as it pertains to your question, what I've argued in my opening brief and what I would argue today is that the reckless disregard is a series of, generally referred to as a series of acts or omissions, recklessly being defined as fully aware of the unreasonable risk he's creating, wantonly defined as he is not trying to avoid it and is indifferent to whether harm results or not. And so they're certainly not, and what the trial court's exact verbiage is, he found that it's resisting someone's attempt to overtake him by speeding up is conduct so gross, wanton, and culpable as to show reckless disregard. And in order for that to be reckless disregard for human life, he would have had to have been aware that his action of speeding up briefly for a short period of time would have then caused an accident. And that is only if this constitutes
to be over the speed limit, though, if someone's trying to, you've just passed someone on a double yellow line, and then they try to get back in front of you, and there's only one lane and no shoulder, and let's say for sake of my question now that they were both going 25 miles an hour, and your client, when appellant sees Mr. Sam trying to get in front of him, he speeds up to 35 miles per hour, and we have the same result here. Why, given the fact there's only one lane and a double yellow line, and presumably there's other traffic that either is there or could be there, coming in the opposite direction or even around your client or your client, Mr. Sam, why isn't that in itself enough to show a reckless disregard for life of either his passengers, Mr. Sam, or others that might be on the road?
Because I don't believe that it's a series of acts or omissions, and that's generally what the case law refers to in constituting the reckless disregard for human life. And I think also the evidence is that the speeding up, the one issue that I have is the trial court made a factual finding that I believe is an error. And he says, the judge says, I believe it was on appendix page 67, that he sped up. He was speeding, and then he sped up in an effort to avoid this. And there was no evidence. The evidence was that he was going the speed limit before that. And so I would be looking at asking the court to look at the totality of the evidence as it pertains to start to finish.
That's part of the question I just asked you. Let's assume, even for sake of my question, that he was not speeding when that happened. But he did then speed up as considerably to between 55 and 60 miles per hour. Why isn't that enough right there, given his passengers and Mr. Sam and others that might be on the road? He's already passed him on a double yellow line, and now Mr. Sam's trying to pass him on a double yellow line, and rather letting him get back in front of him so they're all, nobody's hurt, he tries to box him out.
And the question being, why is that not reckless disregard for
why
human life?
Why is that reckless disregard for human life in a manner gross, wanton, and culpable?
And my answer, I think, would stay that it's a brief period of time that he exceeded the speed limit. His friend says something. He lets his foot off the gas. He slows down. And that is the point. And the question is whether or not that action actually caused the accident. Is speeding up what led Mr. Sam to lose control of his vehicle? There's no evidence that that in any way contributed to Mr. Sam losing control of his vehicle. Mr. Sam didn't testify. I don't know if Mr. Sam had mechanical failure on his car or a sudden emergency or there's any reason. And so the argument I would make in response is that I don't think that his action is reasonably designed or could be reasonably seen as causing this accident. Which, and his action being speeding up briefly and then taking his foot off the gas and decelerating at that point in time.
Okay, thank you. I don't want to take you off the rest of your argument.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine. So I think we've gone through my argument as far as why I don't believe that was a race. I think we have certainly gone through the reckless disregard, and I think it really what's left of my argument is the causation. And certainly, I think the argument kind of flows through each of the three sections that I don't believe this constituted a race, and I think I've been through why. And I think the issues that I have with respect to the findings are the judge placed stock in the fact that they had known one another, and I don't know what significance that has. I don't think any, because in the evidence that exists, there's no conversation about it. I think the gesture becomes meaningless in light of what happens next, which is they both pull off legally and are driving the speed limit. The excessive speed he certainly relies on and the act of passing, and the passing happens after a mile or a mile and a half. And so I think those things really are why I don't believe that a race happens. And I do take issue with the statement on page 67 that the defendant going a high rate of speed and then both sped up. That's not what the evidence was at the trial. And he referred to that as one of the weightier pieces of evidence, and I don't believe that that finding is actually supported by the evidence in determining that there was a race. But I really would focus on the lack of the conversation, a gesture without response, or really any incident happening afterwards. There's no revving of engines. Each vehicle turns off lawfully. No braking, traction, spinning tires. Going the speed limit for the vast majority.
I don't want to interrupt you, but you're into your rebuttal time.
Oh, I will stop there and reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. All right, Mr. Murphy, you ready?
I am ready. Good afternoon, Your Honor. Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. First of all, with respect to the race, the judge did rely upon that gesture. And, of course, he saw it. So, of course, he's the one probably best suited to interpret it. And he also described it. He said it was a raised open hand, which was raised to 90 degrees. It was then pulled forward, sort of a shaking gesture, which he said could be construed as a signal to go or go forward. And I think he's entitled to interpret it that way. I think that's a reasonable interpretation. But then what he pointed to is that the excessive speed. Now, they were going at the time of the collision 20 to 25 miles over the limit. That's clearly excessive, particularly considering the conditions, the wet road and all that. And the question is, why were they going so fast? And even more importantly, the judge says, is why did they illegally cross the double yellow line? And then he singled in on Sam's conduct. He says, why was Sam trying to get in front? What was the particular reason for him illegally crossing those lines? And the judge said, well, he was obviously trying to get in front. And then he said, why didn't both of them speed up at that time? Because one was trying to get in front, the other one was trying to stay in front. And he said that the defendant made the effort at that point to stay in front. I think it's clear that this is a race. I mean, there's otherwise no reason for them to pull out at that point. They may have traveled together for a while, but, you know, like in most races, at one point one of them's going to try to get ahead of the other. And when Sam tried to do that, defendant prevented it by speeding up. Now, so I think the first part of this is easy. I think this is clearly a race. The judge said the purpose of a race, as anybody else agreed with this, is to get to the finish or the goal first and to be there, and to it's contest of speed. So we had people speeding, and we had an effort on both parties to try to get in front and stay in front while they were traveling along. Now, on the criminal negligence, first of all, if this is a race, and I think it clearly was, then that, by statute, 46.2865, is reckless driving. So that's the start. Now the judge points to the fact that they're on a road, a wet road, it's been raining all day, and it's dark. There are no shoulders. And the police officer said that what you had is a white line on the side, and once you go over that, there's a ditch. And what we have on with those conditions is the defendant resisting Sam's effort to get around him. Now, what the defendant says is, well, but that wasn't foreseeable. Now, I have cited two race cases, O'Connell and DeLauder, and particularly in O'Connell, they go into the foreseeability. And what's important in O'Connell is that there is no contact. The two are riding along together, and the other car goes off the road. Nothing happens to the defendant's car. But because it's a race and because they're doing this, the court said it's foreseeable that one of the drivers would lose control and crash. And that's exactly what happened here. And certainly foreseeable, particularly when the defendant is keeping Sam in a position where he is traveling in the wrong direction in the travel lane on the other side of the double yellow line. And the defendant will not let him get back. You know, it seems to me that they're struggling to get in the position. The likelihood of a collision, a loss of control, is clearly increased substantially at that point. Now, the defendant says, well, but he slowed down before the accident. Well, interestingly, the expert said that at the time of the collision, the vehicles were going 50 to 60, 55 to 60 as a minimum. And if that's true, then they were going even more quickly if he in fact slowed down. And importantly also, he didn't slow down enough to let Sam by. So that he, having been criminally negligent, you know, he then slowed down a bit maybe, and but not enough to prevent the harm that he'd already caused or was likely to cause. So I think the criminal negligence is displayed by that act of saying, no, you're not going to get around me, I'm going to prevent you from passing me, despite all of these conditions. And on causation, don't forget, what we need here is just proximate causation. You can have more than one cause. Anyone who contributes to the eventual accident is liable. And if you look again to O'Connor, O'Connor also discussed foreseeability. As I said, in that case, there was no contact. Just the fact that they were in a race, traveling at a high rate of speed, was enough to give the defendant knowledge of the foreseeability that an accident like this might very well occur. So, and here we didn't have that. We had actually cars banging against each other in an effort by Sam to get back into the proper lane and the defendant speeding up to prevent it. So I think it can be said that there would have been no collision if the defendant had not speeded up to prevent Sam from getting over. So it seems clear that the causation here is that he willfully engaged in a race, he willfully tried to win that race, and in doing so precluded Sam from traveling and getting into the appropriate lane of travel. For those reasons, I think it's clear that it was a race, and during that race, the defendant was criminally negligent and caused that accident. I wonder if the court has any questions.
Mr. Murphy, just one question. How does appellant's driving under a suspended license actually affect anything here? Is that a factor to be considered with regard to the conviction that is before us on appeal, the felony racing?
I don't think so. I'm not sure exactly what the reason for the suspension is. I suppose if, in fact, it was for some bad driving or a history of bad driving, it may make the likelihood of him being engaged in criminal negligence higher, but I don't think I can argue that.
Okay. So basically the fact that he knows it's suspended, because I think he admits that at this point.
Right, yeah.
That's not a factor in any way that adds to the criminal negligence if he's seen to be in a race.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, you could argue that it may show his sort of disregard for the rules of the road in some way, but I think we don't need that because it's so clear that, as the judge said, that, you know, when they both speeded up, you know, that's what did it. You know, they were clearly in a race. They were clearly criminally negligent, and they were both causes of the accident. And if there are no further questions, I request that the decision below be affirmed.
Judge Atlee, anything from you?
I have no questions.
Judge Beals?
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Shelton, you have 5 minutes.
Yes, ma'am. I just would like to follow up about the O'Connell case and foreseeability, because I think it addresses a lot of the issues that I've raised. That is a case that came from Chesterfield, and I think the facts are important to consider about whether this is a race, and then in response to Mr. Murphy's argument. And I argued about the O'Connell case at the trial, and it certainly doesn't give a definition of racing, but there's the finding that that constituted a race, and there you have two guys who've been drinking that have the same car. They're in the parking lot of the Bailey's on Huguenot. There's a challenge that happens in the parking lot. They pull out together. They both start at a high rate of speed. At that point, the road is covered in sand and snow on the side. There's a signal for them to begin. They both end up going in excess of 100. They both lose control, and they both admit, well, one gentleman passed, but one, the driver of the other vehicle admits that, yeah, we were racing. In this case, you have the speed, maybe 55 to 60, it depends, and you have the testimony that he was slowing down as the impact happened by taking his foot off the gas. You have evidence that there's the one pass initially that they then proceed on for a mile, and so we don't have a lot of back and forth lead changing. We don't have a high speed. We don't have them pulling off, and so I guess the Commonwealth's argument is that they were trying to maintain who stays in front, and it, basically that would mean that basically this somehow becomes a race a mile and a half or 2.5 miles into the period of time that they are driving, and then he takes his foot off the gas. And so the best evidence that the Commonwealth has is there is a brief period of time when my client exceeds the speed limit, and the question is whether that brief period of time makes it foreseeable that somehow Mr. Sam would lose control of his vehicle. And I would argue that it does not. And so unless there are questions, I think I would ask that you would reverse and either dismiss or remand as a misdemeanor back to the circuit court.
Okay, any questions from Judge Beals?
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Sheldon.
Thank you so much.
Judge Atley?
No, ma'am.
Okay, well, thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will reconvene in conference without y'all. Have a nice day.
Thank you very much.